Hey folks, welcome to another episode of the 10 Laws podcast with East Forest. I'm East Forest. Today I have a really cool episode with Dr. Robin Carhart Harris, and he is a doctor, as we said, but he's the head of the Center for Psychedelic Research and the Division of Brain Sciences, Faculty of Medicine at the Imperial College of London. Man, if I worked at a place like that, I would definitely say that entire thing all the time. He has designed many functional brain imaging studies with psilocybin, LSD, MDMA, DMT, and clinical trials of psilocybin for the treatment-resistant depression that is out there. So he is in the thick of this research. He's in the middle of all this kind of work. He is the dude, and I've admired what he's been up to for a really long time. So I was overjoyed when he agreed to come on the show. He was out in London. I was in Boise, so we got our time zones as we could. And I feel like I have to tell you when we recorded this in the timeline of COVID-19 because, you know, things are changing so quickly that that's important to the context of the conversation. So this was a few weeks back. And yes, things were in lockdown. Things were moving. I think it was in the early stages of that. And also, a friend of mine was helping me build like an exterior outside door, like a wall door thing here at the studio. And he decided to show up right when I started this and started hacking away and sawing. So I tried to mute my microphone when all that was occurring. But if you hear some background noise, that's what it was. We did our best. But hey, look, we were talking two guys halfway around the world in the middle of a pandemic. So I'm going to count that as a major success. I had a blast talking to him. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. But first, I want to let you know about the live stream that's happening this Saturday, May 2nd at 8 p.m. Eastern. It is another East Forest ceremony. So I've done two. This is the third. But it's in the same energy of those in that it is intended to be a long-form improvisation on my part to get into that space to be guiding deep work together. You can dive into this however you want, whatever feels right to you. That's, you know, could be with your family, chilling out, just watching, enjoying it, relaxing. It could be something much more intentional. I just ask you to be safe and mindful, obey your local laws, of course. But more than anything, it's a chance to listen. It's a chance to listen intentionally to that inner voice within, to clear away all of this noise, all of this stress, and take a moment to hear what I hope and would contend is always there. We just need to cultivate that space to go there and to listen. So I'm going to set the stage with the music, and I invite you to join me this Saturday. It's May 2nd, 2020 at 8 p.m. Eastern. It'll be on YouTube on my page, which is East Forest Music on YouTube.com. I'll also embed that player on my eastforest.org website. So if you guys want to share that or invite your friends, all that kind of stuff, please do. There should be a Facebook event. And on that note, I want to thank all of you who have been sharing the podcast, who have been sharing music on socials. You've been sending me messages of support. Some of you have been even sending, you know, PayPal donations, financial support. Those of you who have been buying merch is great too. It means a lot to me. You know, it provides emotional support, financial support, and helps me just feel like we're all in this conversation together. And speaking of doing a more intimate conversation, with this ceremony on Saturday, I'm also going to be offering an East Forest Council. We did this for the Music for Mushrooms live stream. I'm going to do it again. I'm going to give it a shot and see how it feels, because ultimately I want to find ways to build more community together, have more of a conversation. So the East Forest Council is a small group, Zoom gathering, where we get together Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern and Saturday. So the day before the live stream and the day after. Saturday is like, I think, 1 p.m. Eastern. And we will, I'll moderate the session. We'll do listening, sharing, talking about our practices, what works. You know, it's a chance to get to know one another and to dive more into our respective practices. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, you can sign up, eastforest.org. It's on the homepage. It's also over on the tour page. There should be a link along with the details for the event. And I'd love to join you if you're feeling called. Please sign up early because it is capped at a particular smaller number. The first 10 people who sign up and give the full amount of the sliding scale have the option to receive a ceremony box. I have a few of those left, and you can also grab one of those too if you're just interested in grabbing one of the last ones. They're all signed and numbered. There's 108 of them, and I think we're down to our last, like, I don't know, 15 or so, maybe 20. And lastly, thanks for giving this podcast a review. You can give it 5 stars right now while I'm blithering and blathering. You just scroll down on Apple Podcasts. At the beginning of the page there, you got to have internet service and give it 5. I appreciate all the comments. It always means a lot to me. I keep doing this because you keep listening and we keep doing this dance together and walking our walk. And that's what it's all about. So let's get into this conversation. I really enjoyed this one. This is Dr. Robin Carhart-Harris. Thanks for doing this. Your name came up a few times, and I've sort of seen it pop up with some of the work you're into that I have some crossover with. And if you could just start and just tell us a little bit about the work you are doing and where you are and who you are.
Sure. So I'm Robin Carhart-Harris, and I head up a Center for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College London. I've been researching psychedelics full-time, directly for about 11 years, maybe a little bit longer, and started my PhD in the general area, psychopharmacology, in 2005. And in that time, I've been fortunate to lead a number of studies looking at how psychedelic drugs work in the brain, looking at psilocybin, which is found in so-called magic mushrooms, doing some kind of foundational brain imaging research using fancy brain imaging techniques like fMRI, MEG, EEG, to look in the brain at its activity when people are on magic mushrooms, essentially. And I've done the same with LSD as well. MDMA, DMT, and most recently things have started to translate into the space of application, and most obviously in mental health, where we're coming very close, virus pending, to completing a large trial, our second trial, looking at psilocybin as a treatment for depression. And in this most recent trial, we've gone head-to-head with the leading standard antidepressant treatment. The drug's called escitalopram. It's a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. People will have heard of Prozac. It's a bit like Prozac. And so we've gone head-to-head there. And that's quite important because it can help people calibrate where we are with psychedelic therapy, you know. Is it right to believe the hype? How good is it really? Well, one way to address that is to go head to head with something which is considered a first line treatment, and see how it matches up. And that more or less brings us up to speed. We founded the center in 2019, thanks to some generous donations from independent individuals. Philanthropists.
Are they privately, do they not want to be known? Are they anonymous? Or are they sort of out there supporting this?
You know, they're really modest about it. I mean, Tim Ferriss is well known, and then the others are, you know, they're not asking me to shout their names out. So I quite respect that discretion. And this is what's happening in this space. You know, people really want to make a difference on a human level.
Is that true for you? Like, when the researchers I've met in this field, you know, whether at NYU or there's often a personal story to you know, whether they had some kind of, there's a motivation deeper than just their certain research interests of like, this is exciting and interesting scientifically, but usually there's a personal level. Is that true for you as well?
Yeah, I think on some level, I think everyone who gets sucked in...
the rabbit hole. Everyone who slips and falls down the,
whether or not
the research psychedelic rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah. And then joins the mushroom cult. yeah. And then it depends, you know, how was it that I, you know, had a clear and obvious mental health disorder? Not really, I wouldn't say. It's more kind of curiosity and life experience brought me in. And then witnessing through the basic science that I was doing and the basic kind of psychological interests that I have. It was kind of that, like, more pure curiosity that drew me in. And then, you know, initially relatively agnostic about the therapeutic potential until it just started to become really, really compelling. And everything we were doing in terms of testing in that space was coming up positive. And then, you know, I guess I've got very much swept up in that optimism.
So before we get into that, I have a lot of questions, but I think it's important to speak to what's happening now with this pandemic. And whenever people are listening to this in the future, let's hope that it's not an issue, but it is an issue. And it sort of feels like we're stepping into a kind of new, I don't want to catastrophize, but it feels like a new sense of being for like the human experience. And we've always known how globally connected we are now and how that's a new thing for humanity. Our supply chains to information, that is the state of the world. We are very connected as a world, and climate change is evidence of that as well. And then here we are with a pandemic that sort of personifies that connection, where it's like, it's actually like, in itself, this global thing and how the way we fly around now, it's just bouncing around the world. And it's so, many of us have felt that the psychedelic work and the renaissance that's happening is in a sense symptomatic of the growth and change that's wanting to become on the planet. You know, a lot of that's kind of a hippie thought. It's like, well, it's Aquarius awakening, and this is it happening. And you're seeing the research, and it's all great, and it's really generational. And here it is. And we've seen that. Yet at the same time, what seems to be happening now, it feels like a quickening of sorts. And not that it's directly related to the psychedelic renaissance, but in some ways it is, because it's all related. And it feels that we're in a time now where it's like, wow, things have come home to roost in a way. You know, there's nowhere to run anymore. And I'm just kind of saying that to state, I don't want to just have this conversation and not acknowledge like where we're both sitting in this moment in different countries, you know?
Yeah, like, it sets the context. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'm not feeling 100%, yeah. And I'm thinking, have I got the virus, you know? And I've just been up to the shop.
Oh, my God.
There's no toilet roll, and there's no eggs as well. That was an odd thing as well. No, the whole row where tissue,
you know, I never would have put my money on that when this would happen. The one thing people would be hoarding the most would be toilet paper. I was like, that would not have been my bet, actually. I would have thought alcohol or something like that, but
yeah. Yes, it's odd. Very odd times. Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, pretty quiet out there. And you know, I've been going into London. I live in Oxford. That's where I am today. But I was in London yesterday, and very spookily quiet, you know, in such a major metropolis.
You're doing as well as any of us are, I presume. Like, you're just kind of taking, I mean, what we're all kind of like, what do we do? I don't know.
It's odd. And you know, we're very close to finishing our clinical trial. We've got 3 dosing sessions left. That's really a very difficult dilemma, whether what's the ethical thing to do. Do you commit to a treatment that is that is incomplete, because these are treatment-seeking individuals who likely, you know, desperately want to have their second treatment session in this case. Or do you say the risk is too high, you know, everyone should be on lockdown because things aren't that way in the UK at the moment? It's a very difficult dilemma, and that's been a very acute theme today, different opinions in our team about whether we commit to finishing our trial or whether we have a different kind of obligation where we say, look, this is, you know, exceptional circumstances. There is an ethical reason actually to stop.
Yeah.
Early.
Well, looking at the very long difficult. View, I think we could both agree that there's psychological and emotional and spiritual potential for the role of psychedelics to come more into the mainstream fore of society to help. And to help with all the challenges we face. We've already faced so many interesting challenges with information overloads and people just trying to navigate modernity. But now we're in a really, really special challenge. So I would assume, you know, you guys again are inside a system that's trying to bring this into like mainstream four and do it through the scientific method, which is admirable and great. With that thought in mind, let's imagine this would be applicable to what we're facing now, or just sort of the transitions we're facing now psychologically as people. And assuming we'll continue to face these, you know, do you see promise? What kind of promise are you seeing for psilocybin and other psychedelics to help us navigate things, for well people to be more well, and also to work with people who have particular psychological issues, be that depression or something more?
Yeah, I mean, the therapeutic benefits are very fundamental, and the obvious place that this is going, you know, in terms of what could change policy in relation to psychedelics, you know, presently illegal and in many cases in the highest bracket of sort of, you know, harm according to whatever your, you know, whoever your government is. What would change that? Well, it's the development work that could bring, I think really it is the development work that could bring psychedelics into, you know, the medical domain as licensed medicines. You know, what I'm aware of, and many of your listeners will be aware of, I'm sure you're aware of it, that with psychedelics, it's so the treatment, the experience is so sort of fundamental that it seems to go beyond just like remediating.
Yeah, the spiritual element seems like it's a big part of it.
It seems to implicate.
I don't know if that came through. I was just saying like the mystical role.
Yeah, I think it is. And that's, yeah. Yeah, it's very relevant. And, you know, what do we do with that? And given the history of religion, relatively, you know, young history, I suppose, a few thousand years, and a human phenomenon, as far as we can tell, what do we do with the experiential components of religion, I suppose? What will be the cultural shift when we start to understand the nature of the spiritual, mystical experience? And then how's that going to affect the way we think about ourselves and our place, yeah, in the world? And that, it's, you know, it's, everything's interconnected. It's very much interrelated with mental health, but not everyone sort of knows that. That's not obvious to everyone. And I think that's perhaps one of the most powerful implications of where we are with psychedelics and that impact on how we view ourselves and the potential, you know, I'm tempted to say, forgive me for saying this, but the potential to demystify the mystical, and what would be the implications of a more complete understanding, perhaps not entirely complete as our understanding of things, you know, of science, they're never absolute. You know, we have theories and such like.
Demystifying the mystical, though. That's a really interesting phrase that you said. So I was talking with someone else the other day about their view sort of on the psychedelic experience, and it was very different than mine in a sense. They saw it very rational, reductionist, like, well, this is, you know, my unconscious and I'm waking things up chemically and I'm having this experience. And it is a mystical experience in the sense of it's self-defined that way, but they kind of were saying, that's it. It's limited to your internal experience. And one way or the other, I kind of think like, regardless, the mystical experience or the spiritual element, even the ceremonial element from my own anecdotal experience of working with people, plays a large role in the effectiveness of the experience for them, like the power of it psychologically and emotionally. And is that something you're working with in the research, or can you, is it even, or do you need to put that aside so that your data is like cleaner in a way?
I don't think, I mean, if people report it and describe it, it is the data, you know, and we measure it and people do describe it and report it. And so that's what, so we treat it, you know, as important and valid. And we know it's important and meaningful because it predicts therapeutic responses. So if people have these profound mystical type experiences, they're more likely to be doing better in the longer term. All I would say, and it's a nuance really, is that it's an issue of framing. You know, one person's mystical experience is a confirmation of the existence of a monotheistic God that they think about in relation to a particular religion, for example, or somebody else thinks of it as evidence of a transcendent spirit that is beyond physical, and somebody else thinks of it as a realization of our fundamental interconnectedness that in no way appeals to any kind of spooky metaphysics at all. And, you know, it may well be the case that all of these people have had the same experience, essentially, but they've interpreted the experience slightly differently.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's sort of like hypnosis, where what we're saying and what's coming through our mouths in a way is filtered through our consciousness, like English and so forth. And the psychedelic experience, I often think, is the same way. It's sort of occurring through the lens of our consciousness. Like if we're in the jungle or if we had Catholic upbringing, we might see Jesus. And that might be like the manifestation in our minds of a vision versus someone who's more nature-based. And perhaps it's whatever it is for them, but it's like, underneath it all, there's a feeling, and there's a feeling that people often speak of connectedness, of oneness, that feels positive to them. It feels healing to them. It feels, and it seems to be engendering something positive for humanity, a kind of like brotherly love, compassion, qualities that would help us thread the needle as we move through whatever it is we're moving through in civilization, including like what we're going through right now, sort of this whole fear versus love thing. You know, will it bring up more feelings of calm and love? I mean, this gets into all the stuff about microdosing, like not even having like a singular mystical experience journey in a larger dose, but what happens if we were to use some of these tools, LSD or psilocybin or who knows what, in small doses instead of coffee? Like, would it, you know, are these things you've looked into or you think about?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, it's difficult to do control research with microdosing because unlike, say, a standard antidepressant drug or antidepressant trial where you would dish out, you know, the doses that people take home and then they're instructed that you take a capsule daily, you can't do that with microdosing because the ethics committees and, you know, the powers that be aren't going to let you do that. And so that means that in order to do a microdosing study that is true to, you know, a microdosing protocol that you might see described by James Vadiman or Paul Stamets, it would be dosing, you know, two or three times a week. So we would have to have people coming in for, say, 4, 5, 6 weeks, you know, 2 or 3 times. And that, so logistically, that becomes really challenging. So we haven't done that yet. I think there might be a team. I think maybe Maastricht in the Netherlands might be trying to do this. I'm not sure what's happening in the States. But we've done other kinds of research, collecting naturalistic data when people are microdosing. And a colleague of mine, David Arizzo, and his collaborator, it's called Ballas, they've been working on a very clever design where they empower the microdoser to follow a blinding protocol. So they become their own sort of scientist, in a sense. I mean, they're self-experimenting anyway, and we have tried to, you know, tap into that and have people who are using psychedelics out there in the world contribute data to research by signing up on this psychedelicsurvey.com platform that we have. And it's been hugely useful in collecting big data on psychedelic use, finding out, you know, red flags for situations where it's contraindicated and things that people do that are associated with better outcomes as well. But to come back to the microdosing, they've set up a self-blinding microdosing study where you follow this computer-generated algorithm, and there's this complex videos that you watch that take you through how you cut up your microdoses, put some in capsules, others you just close the empty capsule, there's nothing in it, and then you put them in envelopes.
That's
and
fun.
Follow this randomization algorithm, mix it up. Some days you're microdosing and some days you're taking placebo, and then you can see how it's affecting you. And they got some really exciting findings there. And that there's a suspicion among the scientists who know the magnitude of the placebo effect, that at least there's the potential that a lot of what's happening with microdosing is placebo. And even when it's active, when it's doing something, it might be enhancing the nature of what a placebo response is, which is positive expectancy. So that's something worth thinking about. And that's a specific issue, I would say, probably a specific issue to microdosing relative to, you know, full dosing or high dosing. Where there's no denying the magnitude of the experience.
Well, let me talk to you about the role music is playing in your research and what you believe about this role. You know, for myself, it's how all of my work began, was creating music for myself to use in that deeply shamanic meditative, just basically for mushrooms. 11 years ago, I had experiences in my life where I'd had mystical experiences that were singular and thankfully pleasurable, but I sort of was stumbling into them. I didn't know what to make of them. I had no guidance or elders, certainly, but they were powerful and important to me. They spoke to a part of my soul or my unconscious that was really, really tender and wanted to be spoken to. And so I knew that music had played a role in that experience, like whether it was on headphones and it just sort of like a connection with the kind of music in that moment. So I wanted to like create that for myself. And I just started making music with no plan. I was just kind of casually, just by myself, that was what I was doing. And it turned into something that was a singular moment for myself, where I had a meditation or a journey with this album I made, which became my first record, that I really was just making for myself. And it was one of the most beautiful things that ever happened, because it was like I had tricked my ego, or my soul tricked my ego into making this thing for a year without knowing what I was making. And then I was using it as a tool with the medicine to kind of transcend into a new sense of being that I still feel today. And everything began at that moment, really. So from there, I started to recognize the role music could play, not just in introspective states, but with psychedelics in particular. And my medicine that's always worked with me is psilocybin. And so friends started organizing circles for me to guide people with music. And fast forward to 10, 11 years of that, and you're just getting your own anecdotal research about creating a protocol of like, well, this is what works and this is what doesn't work as well, as far as was it a positive and safe, powerful experience for them? Music being the primary guide, besides ritual and ceremony and, you know, that kind of structure. And we know this stuff about set and setting and how that, you know, your expectations and how that sets up how well it goes, essentially, and how mystical it is for you and positive. And I know this is known in the research. But for me, when I do my own research of looking at other indigenous ceremonies and going to experience them myself, whether it's a Lakota sweat lodge that's been done the same way for thousands of years, or ayahuasca ceremony using the Acaros the same way, or a San Pedro ceremony and the songs they sing, music is the central vehicle of all of these ceremonies. It is the ceremony in a sense. And they have, and I can't deny that. So with mushrooms, they didn't come forth with the same tradition. There is some history of that, but it's not certainly as present today as it is with like an ayahuasca ceremony. That's deeply entrenched in a ceremony container, and this is the way it's done. People don't do it recreationally as much. In a lot of the research, I felt from the outsider looking in, the music side of it has been a little bit of an afterthought, or it's sort of like it's recognized that it's important, but not, obviously I'm biased, as important as I think it is, where it's like, this is actually the main guide and vehicle creating the architecture you're in. And I've been working to create essentially a new shamanic tradition that's Western for mushrooms particularly. What do you think about the role of music in the psychedelic experience, particularly in how it interfaces with your research and how people are guided through this in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a key component. A PhD student of mine, my first PhD student, Mendel Kalin.
I've met him.
Essentially.
Oh, yeah, really? We've chatted about his project and doing some work for him, but he's kind of like, I talk to him and then he disappears for a while and then we talk again, but I've been very eager to help him on his work.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating what he's doing. I haven't had the wave paths experience yet, but, you know, more power to him in that sense, you know, what he's doing there. But we put out a paper where... I came up with this phrase of the hidden therapist, you know, and I guess in a sense that's sort of, you know, music as the hidden therapist.
Yeah.
And I hear what you're saying when you say it's like an afterthought, because in a way that title is referring to that, you know, why is it hidden? And why should it be phrased that way? And people say the therapy is non-directive. You know, you don't really do much when you're a guide in a sober sitter, you know, trip sitter for someone who's tripping and you're not. You don't really do much most of the time. But there is this hidden therapist, and that's the music that's, you know, conducting your inner journey. Yeah, there's fascinating scientific questions there. Therapeutically relevant questions about how to utilize music, and some classic ones that come up are, you know, do you have your set playlist and that's what you must surrender to and let it take you on a journey? Or, as Mendel has raised as an interesting question, do you allow some dynamics in there where the music can shift based on your experience? And something that we found out in his research that he was leading was that when people say that the music is, the emotional tone of the music is in alignment or in resonance with your intrinsic emotional tone, then that's where you want to be, you know. But if you're going through a dark night of the soul under the psychedelic and things are difficult and challenging, and you know, you're working through some difficult material, to have some, you know, light, joyous music it's discordant. That's not what you want, you know. And similarly, if you're surfing heaven, you know, and in a bliss state, you don't want the music to be mournful and sorrowful and such like. So, you know, it so happens that sometimes your intrinsic, I suppose, emotional state isn't in concordance or alignment with the music that you're listening to.
You know,
that was
something,
quite an interesting
I may keep talking about this because I'm really interested in this about the music side of things. Have you been able to tap into the Music for Mushrooms soundtrack for Psychedelic Practitioner album I created at all? Could I send that your way?
Yeah, I listen to it a lot. Genuinely, I love your music. That's why this email came through and, hi, it's East Forest. And I was like, really? And yeah, no. Genuinely, no, I've been really looking forward to doing this interview. I listen to your music a lot, and a guide from our previous depression trial told me about this album that was made for the dying process, you know, music to die to. And I thought, what a powerful idea. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And then I discovered it, and Music to be Born to as well. And I just rinsed those albums. I listened to them a lot. And when my newborn came along, you know, some really special personal moments were when he was sleeping and I had Music to be Born to playing. And whenever I hear that, I'm reminded of, you know, this time when the sun was rising and my newborn was sleeping there and this just incredible music was playing. So, no, thanks. Thank you, genuinely.
You're welcome. I wanted to talk about the Music for Mushrooms record because there are some unique aspects that I just wanted to bring to your attention. And I'm sure maybe you already know about them, but we're talking like from music theory's point of view. Like you talked about when sometimes people are in a journey and they want the music to be more this way or that way to match with their emotional state. And on one level, I absolutely hear you. And on the other level, I think about traditional shamanic ceremonies where the shaman is singing their akaros, and that's the one that's being sung. And they're taking the medicine too, and that's the one that's being sung perhaps by the medicine. And sometimes that friction between what you want to change and what is happening is an important part of the journey too, of sort of like, that is the journey, right? And so it's not just about switching the channel. And when I created the Music for Mushrooms album, it was recorded live, improvised live, inside a mushroom ceremony where I had a bit of a microdose. So it's like I could at least say that the energy is in me and I am in the room responding to something happening. So I'm essentially changing based on just my own intuition and energy. And I always wondered, would that translate into an album? Because it's static in a sense, like here's the album, right? But I thought it would give it a try and put it out there because I saw a bit of a hole in that. There's music playlists out there, but there's all these different reasons. I wrote a whole op-ed about this, like why this is different. And the music itself is aiming for a kind of liminal middle ground where it's not negative, it's not positive. There's a tension and release happening to kind of take you somewhere, but it's trying to dance in that space of kind of the middle path. And I think that can be an interesting place to be as a guide, where the music is that non-word-driven guide. It's just an emotional guide to let people then go where they need to go. But there's always that keel to kind of keep them in the middle. And these are the kind of things music, I think, can do that, like, you're already having such amazing results in all the different research that's going on and how powerful it is for people. And I'm sort of thinking, like, man, if we could unlock the full potential of music in these studies, I have a feeling it would be even more powerful for people, which is promising and it's exciting. And I'm waiting to see this interaction between the real music heads, like Mendel, for instance, and being like, okay, now how can we bring this arm of science to understand what really works and what works better inside this psychedelic space with music and create our own new tradition, just as it's been done for thousands of years, but one that speaks to Westerners, that's for us.
These are issues of subtlety and issues, you know, complex issues where there's no, you know, clear
right.
sort of binary solution, you know. There's that phrase that that many of us have heard, the medicine gives you not what you want, but what you need, you know. Yeah, this question of, and it divides opinion whether if you're moving towards into a challenging experience, should you, you know, follow that and let surrender to that and you know, and work through it. And our position generally is trust the process and trust where your mind is gravitating towards, because there's a reason and there's something to, you know, to work through. I think that rule is true, but I think it's a reasonable question to ask as to whether it's true absolutely. And this is where we can appeal to data a little bit. I mean, we do have data that says that, and here actually I'm citing others' work, Hopkins specifically, where they found that the duration of a challenging experience is associated with worse long-term outcomes. So a challenging experience itself isn't necessarily associated with like a worsening of mental health outcomes, but if it dominates the experience and there's no breakthrough, there's no catharsis, then that's not really good news according to the data. And it was inspired by realizations like that we developed a scale that we call the emotional breakthrough inventory. And this is intended to supplement the already existing measures and try and get at that question of, you know, within your journey, within your experience, you know, there could be heaven and hell, but was there a breakthrough? You know, if there was hell, did it dominate, or was it processed, and did you feel like you overcame?
Speaks to the role of a guide something. Or sort of that container to help you kind of, so we don't go just into like loops of challenge and then you're kind of, that could be traumatic. I mean, certainly I've had those experiences in my life, you know, where I've had a journey that I'm still kind of traumatized because there was sort of like, I couldn't get through something or out of something in a way. And it gives me a lot of caution and pause myself. So I definitely hear that. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, this is a bit speculation, but the timeline you're kind of feeling and sensing, and then the community and science and also in the public at large. I know how things are in the States with psilocybin particularly, and it keeps getting put on ballots to be either decriminalized or legalized in different ways. And so there's an energy there. And now with everything going on, I'm curious how that will affect people's motivation. If it goes further, faster, I don't know. Where are you seeing this all going, and on what timeline?
I think about that a lot because I'm kind of caught in the middle of it a bit. It's moving so fast at the moment, and now there's a lot of commercial money coming in that's sort of changing the climate a little bit and complexifying things. It's difficult to know. I mean, I do believe in the research and the therapeutic potential and a definite, you know, net positive if psychedelics get through and achieve marketing authorization, you know, the efforts of the different organizations, MAPS being one of them in relation to MDMA, and then others with psilocybin, USONA, Compass. That's the most obvious thing that's really going to change things, you know, because then in North America and Europe, you have these compounds recognized as, and really it's not just the compounds, it's the package, psychedelic therapy, rightly, being licensed as a medical intervention, you know, for particular indications. that's really going to change things on a big scale, because then, you know, the policy has to change. They can no longer be Schedule One drugs because they have recognized medicinal value. And then there are these other sort of backdoor initiatives, in a sense, where you have the decriminalization initiatives and then the legalization initiative in Oregon, proposing to legalize psilocybin therapy and magic mushroom therapy. Those are really interesting, but a bit complex, particularly the decriminalization ones, because I do think there's something to be said for a degree of regulation. You know, my spirit is towards the libertarian side of things, but not entirely. And I do think there is something to be said for a degree of regulation and safeguarding, because the agents are so powerful. And what is quite likely is that those arguably who are most vulnerable and often the youngest, section of the demographic are those who are going to, in a sense, misuse the substances if they can. And so I think that, you know, in the same way that you do responsible things if you're a parent, you know, you do have some principles and some rules and some boundaries. I think if we just, you know, charge on and decriminalize without thinking through safe rollout and regulation and infrastructure, then we could hit a few problems. So the Oregon initiative is different because they have thought those things through. And I think people can take a lot of inspiration from what's been going on with that. And I actually think, you know, if the Oregon initiative gets through, which so the listeners understand, and hopefully I'm right here, would mean that in the state of Oregon, not federally, but in the state of Oregon, psilocybin therapy would essentially be legalized. And there are certain things written into the motion that around training and you know, certain levels of certification and professionalism in order to be able to deliver the therapy, but that's, you know, that's on the that potentially, I'm not quite sure of the latest, but there's a decent chance, I think, that would be within the ballot this year, you know, in the elections, and so it could get through this year. I mean, so that's very close, of course. You know, that could mean in the state of Oregon, magic mushroom therapy, psilocybin therapy is a legal phenomenon. Of course, it could get shut down in a complex way, as things have happened with medicinal marijuana in the US. It could get shut down, you know, by, in terms of federal law enforcers coming in, but that I mean, just reflecting on that would be so problematic. You know, just thinking of a nightmare scenario where the feds come in, you know, mid-session, that would be so unethical and such a misunderstanding of this whole thing. But that's something that I'm quite supportive of, the Oregon Initiative. I met the people behind that and went over and spoke at a fundraising event for them. I think there are hidden pitfalls with the rollout. I don't think it's all just, woohoo, here we go, you know, legalize psychedelics. And there's some, you know, some subtle nuances that we need to think about. What are the, you know, given that this treatment, this experience, these medicines are so powerful and can so fundamentally change people's perspectives, what are the broad implications of, you know, a decent chunk of the population changing in this fundamental way? I do think that's, the net effect is a positive one. But there are some potential complications to consider as well. I think, you know, with a mass kind of scale up of
What are your thoughts then on
use of psychedelics?
Compass Pathways or USONA or like companies that are coming up and with a bit of a secretive, well, there's a lot of speculation about what's really going on, or the idea of creating a new pharmaceutical behemoth in order to create psilocybin. Because at the end of the day, I think what's needed really is information and resources, because like with the like teenagers and stuff that you spoke of, I mean, they're doing it, they always have, and they're going to keep doing it. And if anything, like myself, you stumble into experiences, whether they're good or bad or positive or negative for you. And that's what I think we need. It's sort of the same way we don't have rites of passage much for kids anymore, or we don't have really as many elders and ways of speaking about these things and what it means to be growing up. And that's what we need. And what I don't want is, I share your concerns, and I also think about the social justice of psychedelics, where it's like, I don't want it to be behind a paywall, where it's thousands of dollars to do the therapy, or you have to have a certain kind of insurance, or you're in the inner city, and it's like, this just isn't part of your reality. And it's like, well, if it's out there for everybody, where within the case of psilocybin, it's growing out of the ground, it's more about like, how can we open up these resources to people and give them guidance and give them information and give them tools, because it's going to happen. And in some ways that's happening as well, but I'm kind of more in the middle ground myself, where it's like, I want the research, I want the information, and I also want a freedom to that information and sort of an egalitarianism of it being accessible to people. So I was going to ask you about Compass Pathways and stuff, because I'm sure you've definitely thought about that and maybe even had interactions with them. And what the hell are they up to? Like, what's going on with that, with these people?
Yeah. Again, you know, I think it's easy to project onto to things, especially when they seem to be, you know, attracting big investment, doing big things, and into that unknown in such a, you know, space that many people consider sacred. It's easy to see that somehow they're,
it's good to be
like
skeptical too.
Operation,
yeah.
Trying to, you know, monopolize this and
absolutely
it is. But I mean, I know them quite well. I know USONA, you know, have a privileged position in that sense, so I can get to check them out. And it's, you know, like so many things, it pays to be balanced. My hope, so the high level thing to say is that my hope is that there's nothing prohibitive in terms of access pending the relevant sensible safeguarding is in place. So I really don't want cost to be prohibitive, and I hope that there's a way to manage the rollout so that it's not. At the moment, the cost effectiveness calculations break that right down, you know, how expensive this is for people, whether privately or, you know, through their insurance policies, or whether in you know, public healthcare systems this will be integrated, whether it's cheap enough to be integrated. That's one of the key problem areas with the rollout of psychedelic therapy, is that it's quite resource expensive, in that you take your Prozac drugs,
generic,
for example, they're cheap because they're generic, and then you dish out the drugs and people take them away. And the key thing is that there's no extra professional oversight. I mean, people suffer from depression. They go to their doctor and they say, I'm feeling low. Oh, here's your prescription. And it's done and dusted in like 10, 15 minutes sometimes. I mean, so that's actually resource inexpensive, in the real expense there, which is the clinician's time, was only like 10, 15 minutes in the consultancy, whereas it's hours for the
multiple days
the trip
of integration and therapy
journey.
And,
So that's a lot. I mean, it's not as bad as something like psychoanalysis, but it's not great, you know. And so that's a key challenge. One thing that I'm conscious of is that things evolve, you know, in the end, they evolve how they evolve and they find a way, and the thing that makes most sense happens. And as you say, these things grow out the ground, you know. There's something already very organic about the whole thing. I anticipate, you know, that in the end, even if there's a period that's rocky and, you know, the hype cycle collapses, for example, that, you know, psychedelic therapy will be democratized and decentralized, and people, and when that happens, it doesn't mean some
it's been happening free-for-all on the underground for many decades. And I mean, we have to step back and state the obvious, as you said. Like, I mean, this stuff grows out of the ground and we're told not to touch it. It's like, we're all here on this planet. It's right there. You're telling me I can't like change my mind and consciousness on my own, like without affecting other people? It's a very strange situation we're in. And with psilocybin in particular, I mean, you can tell someone how to teach them how to grow it themselves, and they're not supposed to do that either. But if they wanted to, they have that ability. You can't go make Prozac on your own. You know, it's like they're just other plants and fungi that are out there. So it is an odd situation we're in, where perhaps when at least with the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, Nixon, somebody was freaked out, and they're just like, we got to put the kibosh on this because there was a fear about some kind of social change. And what's ironic about, as the generations have shifted, we're now in a place where that social change is what we need and want. We're like, okay, wait a minute. How do we fix these inherent problems we have of not working together, of feeling separated and isolated and siloed? And so maybe these tools have a way, or at a minimum, of helping fix the symptoms of that isolation, which is often depression, anxiety, addiction, and maybe they can just help with that. So there is this sort of bittersweetness to it all, how it's kind of coming back. It's like, yes, you threw the baby out with the bathwater in a sense, but maybe these tools are just that, very powerful tools for us to use. So I'm happy you guys are doing this research.
Yeah. But thank you. Yeah, I mean, it truly is a privilege to be doing it. Again, there's a nuance there, and it speaks again to, you know, a natural evolution of things. Maybe in the 60s, there was a bit too much, arguably, of a push to kind of popularize psychedelics, and even people thinking all we need to do is spike, you know, the powers that be in order to change the world. And you know, the as we know very well as clinical researchers, it's good practice to get consent.
And critical when you give someone a psychedelic. Their element of choice of wanting to do it and the intention they're bringing into it is, it dictates the experience itself. It's not like it's a panacea that they take and that's that. It's like their choice in the matter and what they want out of it is really kind of everything.
Yeah. And so that's something to be mindful of, you know, the social change element, because, you know, we see it, we suspected it, you know, measured it and saw it, that people change in their political views and in their sensed relationship to nature. But we stopped short as researchers, or at least I did, and I think our team did, from saying, therefore, you know, people should go out and take more psychedelics because it will solve climate change. You know, that is stepping out of one's role as a scientist and into another role as like an activist. And that is. And another thing that I'm conscious of is that if the message is fundamental, and what is the message, you know, what's the great wisdom that people have come to through taking psychedelics? Well, you might say one of them is that fundamentally there's a fundamental interconnectedness. You know, we're all in this together, and what we do influences each other and the world around us. And that's a fundamental realization. You know, realizations about self and ego as well. But are these realizations that have only come about through taking psychedelics? Well, I think it's fair to say that no. maybe they're realizations that have come about most often during altered states of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And then we can think of meditation and, you know, the realizations that have led to wisdom teachings and such like. But I think there's a really, really important realization there, which is that in a sense, psychedelics could be redundant if you could get to that realization. And so maybe there's something to be said, although it's difficult, and I get this, and, you know, challenging times, difficult times. Yeah,
use the tools that work extreme the fastest times. And the best.
Call for extreme measures.
If you don't have 20 years to sweep the ashram floor.
Yeah, I hear that, but equally, I just wonder when the world starts to accelerate in the way that it's changing, you know, that might sort of naturally drive, of course it can go one of two ways, but it might naturally drive some of the realizations that we come to through psychedelics. Like at the moment with the pandemic, I think one of the kind of silver linings is that, you know, whether you're in China or Australia or the UK or the US, we're all thinking about the same thing, you know, and we jump on these Skype calls and mm-hmm. it's in all of our consciousness, like, you know, really thick at the moment that it isn't it scary what's going on? Climate change, it's a matter of time until that's closer to the front of our consciousness. But that's going to happen too. And so, again, you know, if the realization is fundamental, it does make sense to me that we would come upon it even without having to have
all roads lead to Rome, indeed. And the spirit of our incarnations, the soul sets up the lesson until you learn, however that lesson comes. I feel that, you know, the psychedelic experience is one experience inside the same operating system that you learn from tragedy, you learn from change, you know, we learn from everything. And I don't think that the psychedelic is the cure for any one person, actually. It's just one more role. And for some of us, it can be a big one. As you said sometimes people change their political beliefs. I would assume they just get more conservative. Is that correct that you found in your research? Or is that a... Oh, is that so? Okay.
They get more libertarian, less authoritarian. Surprise. Yeah, yeah. And a shift.
I'm joking. But I know time is precious, and I would like to close this just by asking you, what's some of the most exciting things that results, or even like a particular story, if you're able to tell a story that you've, like, something has happened, might have been synchronistic, or just a promise that you're feeling in your own heart about this that is giving you a lot of hope for the future, or something that might have occurred in your research or in your own life during this process?
I can't get out of my head the depression trial that we're close to finishing, because the implications are so big, and it sort of feels like, in a way, the culmination of a journey that I started when I moved from psychoanalysis, doing a postgraduate qualification in that, and then going on to do a PhD in psychopharmacology, into a culture of, you mm-hmm. know, drug company funding and a dismissal of psychological intervention and even psychological theories of mental illness, you know, and then feeling that that's not right, you know, and so much is being missed within psychopharmacology in terms of the depth of the psychology of the human experience. And in a similar way, so much is being missed in psychoanalysis and depth psychology in terms of good science and rigor and pragmatics as well. And so I sort of feel like this journey, like personal journey, and sure, it's a professional one, but it's kind of personal as well. Is this kind of, I'm hoping, will be a kind of middle way in terms of mental health care. That you know, you do need a drug here. It's not happening by magic, and we do know how the drug works on the brain at a molecular level, like pretty precise level. That's where it starts, and then we're just starting to get a handle on how the changes in brain dynamics relate to the changes in the dynamics of experience. But we are just getting it, you know, scratching the surface there, but we're getting some insight. But it's a drug, but it's also deeply psychological, and the therapeutic model needs to be that. And to see where we are at the moment, looking at the preliminary data in our head-to-head depression trial, where the findings look so exciting going head-to-head with this first-line antidepressant, you know, I can't think of it. I tried to think of something else that was maybe more personal, more revealing about me as an individual. But this is...
it's exciting, yeah.
It's going to be massive.
Yeah, a lot of people mentioned that they find anecdotally that psilocybin helps them with depression. And I'm sure part of that is a chemical thing going on in the brain. And part of that, I think, is the psychological, the experience itself. Like, it's doing something psychologically. Like, that's why I think that container of ceremony and it feeling like that is a very important part of them feeling better as well, I think, versus just taking a pill.
Well, yeah, I mean, but on that theme, in keeping with the principle of interconnectedness, things are never just physical and not informational or experiential. So, you know, there's two sides to this coin. And for me, there's something, you know, that's sort of middle way about that, that, you know, it's not reductionistic. It's not entirely materialistic. It's some kind of dual aspect view on mind and brain, where you treat them as like equivalents in a way, equivalent importance. Mm-hmm. You don't depreciate either part. And that's the essence of psychedelic therapy. And it's different. It's a different model to the drug treatments. And it's a different model to psychotherapy alone. Because, of course, psychotherapy alone, the reality is it has an effect on the brain. And drug treatments, the reality is it has an effect on psychology and experience. So even though the history of psychiatry and psychology has been this divided house of you're either a biological person, accused of reductionism and often perhaps rightly so, and then the other extreme, you are in the psychological camp where you're suspicious of the biomedical model, and you don't ascribe any importance to biology. And I really believe in a similar way that to potentially make advances in terms of understanding mystical type experiences, spiritual experiences, and the essence of religion will be catalyzed by psychedelic science. In the same way, you know, we can have a profound effect on psychology and psychiatry through this kind of hybrid, intrinsically hybrid quality of
well, that's the best solution, right? Is that we have this, it all coming together, science bringing a bit more of the honoring the role of the mystical as the things we can't measure, or they're really hard to measure, and it's the role that they play, and that there's the mystery is just a word we say to like the ineffable, you know, that we sense is part of this experience, if not a large part. But not to say like that's unimportant. It's like, well, that has a role at the table too. And we'll try to do our best to figure out how to bring it all into the same happy family and protocol. One last question. I don't know if you can answer this. Yeah. People often also ask me, and I try to stay out of this, but they're like, you know what I'm going to say, about dosage. And I say, well, look, it's so individualistic to everybody anyway. And moreover, it feels really tricky for me to get into that water. But I've noticed that in some of these studies, they do talk about just like for depending on your tolerance, medium versus low versus high, and what was sort of the magic Goldilocks zone for them having the most positive yet powerful experience. And is it true that that tends to be in that sort of medium to medium strong, like not too strong, but not too weak?
Yeah, it is. I thought you were going to just ask me straight up whether I've taken psychedelics. I get that a lot.
I mean, I hope you have.
I'm glad you didn't.
Okay, yeah. But I honestly, yeah, it's up to you.
Yeah, good. So dosage and, I mean, absolutely, that's it. But that's true across the board, you know, that there are Goldilocks zones for doses, you know. I think there's some probably old saying, I can't quite remember who said it, about what determines a poison or not is dose, from, you know, a medicine to a poison. And so there's this, like, you know, inverse U, we call it, this sort of critical zone, the sweet spot, Goldilocks zone, where the dose is right. And with psychedelics, you know, maybe that's saying something about microdosing that people need to be a little bit more mindful of, you know. They're treating microdosing like it's another Prozac sometimes, and just perhaps that needs to come into the narrative a little bit more, that it's still the same thing and it's still kind of lubricating the mind, sensitizing you to context. And if you're not aware of that, then it could be problematic. And I mean, there's, just to come a bit more closer to, I think, your question, there is this interesting thing with psychedelics where there may be a sort of, there may be a problematic dose.
Yes,
where it's like
not strong enough and,
you know,
not, it's not very weak either. Yeah.
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 Yeah. And you know, something that I've talked to colleagues about is that, it's this capacity of psychedelics to agitate neuroses, you know. And I think that's an issue with microdosing, because if you don't have therapeutic support and a commitment to therapeutic work, and you have a compound that is agitating neuroses, then you could run into some, you could run into some problems, you know. What you do with the high dose model is like push through with the drug. You could even argue that that's a little heavy handed, you know, and impatient. You've just blown through the defenses rather than got to know them, agitated them a little bit, prodded and poked them to try and understand them. It's all conditional on your commitment to the therapy, really. You know, the other extreme is that you smoke 5-methoxy-DMT and break through any kind of, you know, defense and personal learnings, and just straight into, you know, the pure consciousness or whatever. But then, you know, there's interesting things to reflect on there about bypassing the personal work and whether that can catch up with you if you have, you know, just, taking the helicopter to enlightenment, you know. So it's all, there's a lot of conditionals here, and so the key thing I would say is that while dose is critical, you know, you're always qualifying dosage versus how much you're committing to personal therapeutic work. I would argue for the you know, essential value of that.
Well, that's a good sober answer. And you're right. You know, how much work and will you're willing to put forth into just the work of your life, the integration of it, and paying attention outside the experience itself is kind of everything. So there's so many avenues we could discuss. Yeah. And I just really appreciate you giving the time, especially amidst the turbulence of what's going on, to join us. And I would hope that in the future you could come back and update us on what's going on, because there's a lot of misinformation out there and you're in the trenches of the actual research. So it's been a real honor to speak with you, and great to be able to meet you personally. And thank you.
It's been an honor for me. Yeah, genuinely.
Yeah,
and
it's more to come. I'm exploring the ideas of doing live streaming ceremonies during this time, and I might be doing one this weekend and see how it goes, and a form of global meditation, but people can obviously do what they want with that long form musical experience that is live. And I hope that that can be a way of giving further tools, further information. Yeah. How can people best connect with yourself or whatever you'd like to point them to?
Oh, I guess I would give a shout to psychedelicsurvey.com. You know, if people are self-experimenting, I think there's value, like mutual value, win-win all around for people to be, you may as well make it data. And we're going to improve that system because at the moment it's a bit cumbersome and too many measures, but we're aware of that. And then personally, probably just, the anti-social media thing, as my friend calls it, David Glowacki, Twitter, find me on Twitter. Otherwise, the email thing, none of us like email. So probably just a Twitter follow is the way to do it. And we've got a website for our Center for Psychedelic Research. It should pop up. Watch out for our depression trial. We've got a lot. Really exciting stuff coming in the next year or two.
Sounds good. I notice that a lot of people in the psychedelic research fields, they say on their websites, do not email me. Because I'm feeling you're inundated with ridiculous questions all the time. I even get some of them and I'm like, are you serious? But anyway, thank you so much and stay safe. We will talk soon.
Thank you. Yeah, stay.
Cheers.
Stay safe and stay well. Take care. Bye-bye.
Wow, thank you so much, Robin. Thanks for sticking with me from so far away in this time of no toilet paper to come together to talk. It's always something I really appreciate when I get to just talk to people I admire. This song that you're hearing in the background is called Spread, and it's from the Music for Mushrooms album, so I felt like it's appropriate to share some of that work given this conversation. You can find that wherever you listen to music. It is included in high resolution inside the ceremony box on a thumb drive because it's a 5-hour album and it's so damn big it doesn't fit on any other medium. And if you want it in high resolution, good God, that's a big file. But 24-bit goodness. I'll see you this Saturday, May 2nd, for the East Forest Ceremony live stream. I'm working my best to get prepared for that. And if you'd like to join the council, East Forest Council, I'll see you on Friday, right before that. I think we'll close the signups to that on Thursday night. This weekend, I'll also be participating in the virtual summit of Awaken Futures, which is combining psychedelics, meditation, and technology. Lots of amazing speakers. If you want to hop on that train and see all sorts of amazing talks, it's very interactive too. I have more information about that on my website, and you can just look up Awaken Futures, the Awaken Futures Summit. So that's May 1 through 3, and I'll be doing a little concert for the end of that as well. And if you look hard, I'm also doing a little live stream for Marmoset Music, my friends out in Portland, Oregon. That's on Friday the 1st. I know, lots and stuff. I like to say yes. What can I say? And other than that, thank you so much again for sharing the podcast and all your support. You guys just keep walking your walk. I will see you next week. Don't take any shit. But if you do, you know what to do. Do it with grace.